www.wbaipeoplesconvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best in leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
Beautiful, sunny, 76 degrees day in New York City. I'm Sri Srinivasan, host of Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. Today is our 12th show, and we're so grateful to everyone who's called in and to all of our guests. 12 shows means 3 months of coping with COVID, 3 months of lockdown in New York City, and we're still not sure when we can open up the way we'd all like it to. Thank you for supporting WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-supported progressive radio. We're here right now in New York City and worldwide on WBAI.org. Make sure your friends and family can listen outside of New York, too. On Coping with COVID-19, we discuss various aspects of the crisis, but we focus on its effects on society's most vulnerable, workers, the poor, the marginalized, and talk to ordinary citizens and experts. Let's learn together. Today we have a fabulous show with amazing speakers, and I'll tell you about them in just a minute, but a little bit about my own background. I host daily shows about COVID-19 on my YouTube channel, Srinet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T, and I'm the Marshall Loeb Visiting Professor of Digital Innovation at Stony Brook University. And I've spent 25 years working at iconic New York City institutions. I was the chief digital officer of Columbia, then the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then the city itself, working in the basement of City Hall. All three of those New York City icons, like millions of New Yorkers, have been disrupted as never before. Our beloved city has become the U.S. epicenter of the crisis, even as we see things get worse in other places. We're calling this show Helpful and Hopeful so that we can emerge stronger, and emerge we will. But we aren't going to pretend everything is fine like someone we know in D.C. We're going to be clear-eyed and share factual, useful information and stories throughout the show. These past couple of weeks, we've seen lots of anger in our nation, and for good reason. We have seen protests that have occurred all over the country, even in other countries, in light of police brutality, specifically the murder of George Floyd, and we have seen also now other cases of police brutality. The thing that strikes me the most, that when they know all the cameras are on, the police are being so vicious and so cruel. Not in all cases, but imagine what happens when the cameras are not there. Hopefully our show today will help us come to terms with everything that we're dealing with around the country. We want to hear from you. Please call in, share your thoughts, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, or email me, sree@sree.net, sree@sree.net. We have a two-hour show. We'll be live till 2 p.m. Eastern, and we have three fabulous guests. For our first hour, our guest will be Sapphire, author of the book Push, which went on to become the Oscar-winning film Precious. She has so much to say and so much to share with all of you. We also have two board members from Justice Aid. Randy Harden and Therese Steiner will be here, focusing on how you can fight voter suppression and help increase voter engagement. So for now, let's bring on the author, poet, and amazing lady, Sapphire. Hello.
Hello, how are you? I'm very happy to be here.
I am so honored that you would join us, Sapphire. I've gotten to have you speak with me on our video show, but here we are on the radio. There's something special about radio, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the oldest mediums that we have, and it's been used a lot from World War II on down during times of crisis.
And we are in crisis, and so we want to first start with the question I ask all my guests, Sapphire. How are you? How's your family? What's going on around you?
What I'm seeing, I'm in Brooklyn, and I live in a condominium, and one block down the street from me is a homeless shelter. So I'm seeing people who out my window. I'm seeing people who are. It's impossible for them to do socially distancing behavior. There seems to be a lot of difficulty with people managing addiction at this time, so drug deals are taking place. So it's a troubled time. For me, I am having to socially distance for medical reasons and for age reasons, being over the age of 65. So I have my activism has taken the part of trying to support other people who are able to march and writing as much as I can and looking into which organizations. I try to imagine if I was out there and got arrested, I think the most important thing would be to find, bail funds that you can contribute money to and things like that. But, and also constantly assessing the information that is coming out, you know, trying to stay in touch with reality. And the reality right now is that we are living in a changed world.
And that world is something that we will explore with you over the next hour. We're delighted and honored to have you with us for the whole hour. Let's tell people a little bit about your work and what you're doing right now. People know you as a writer and author, and of course, the book Push, which became the novel, which became the movie Precious, mm-hmm. had such an impact on the world. And mm-hmm. let's start there. We have the anniversary coming up next year, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be the next year will be the 25th anniversary of the publication of Push. The publishers are going to put out a special 25th anniversary edition with a foreword and an afterwards. The book came out of my artistic focus on marginalized people, my own experience as a marginalized person, and what it means to live in poverty, what it means to live as the survivor of abuse, what it means to live in a class-based society where class is conflated with skin color. The darker you are, the more likely you are to live in public housing, the more likely you are to go to prison, the more likely you are not to get married and to have children outside of a marriage contract. And that also it extends within the black race. So the darker the black person is, the more likely they are to get a long prison sentence. Two black people can commit the same crime. And if one looks like Halle Berry and the other looks like, me, I would get the most time. So skin color has been conflated to a horrific degree in this culture with what happens to you. We can even look at George Floyd and other people who have been victims of police violence. These are all noticeably dark-skinned black people. So all of that has been a part of what I write about. I'm still writing about those things. I'm now looking into the lives of poor women who are really having to, traditionally, all the way back to after the Civil War, we were supposedly freed, and what that meant in terms of women's freedom and women being forced into prostitution and various other things. So I'm really trying to look at those issues and examine those issues. And this is the focus of my work.
And thank you for doing all of that work. You've helped thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people understand a glimpse of a world or worlds they may not see. Even what you just made, the point you made about colorism within people of color or groups of people of color, is so important and something that we can explore. We want to remind folks that you are listening to WBAI. We are taking your phone calls, 212-209-2877. We're talking to Sapphire, the poet and author of the novel Push, which became the Oscar-winning Precious. She was someone who has seen poverty up close. And the story of the young woman is also about a woman who had to endure poverty and abuse. The film was hugely successful with 6 Academy Award nominations, among other accolades. And so we are just very excited to hear from Sapphire. She also has, Sapphire does, so much to share about the situation we're going through, and you've already heard a little bit of it, and we want to make sure your voice is heard as well. So as soon as you can, we will bring you in to 212-209-2877. I also want to tell you that Ms. Sapphire is on Twitter now. She's a new tweeter, and she is at Ms. Saph. So M-S-S-A-P-P-H. M-S-S-A-P-P-H. And she will be sharing, as the days and weeks go by, more of her thoughts, but she's just gotten started. So everyone, please do follow her and help her see the magic of Twitter as she learns. We're all learning about something, and she's learning Twitter at this moment. Let's talk about what's going on. One of the things you said to me on our other show was that we're all focused on things that may not be the right things. We are constantly saying, wash your hands. But in Native communities, large percentages of people have no access to running water. How are they supposed to wash their hands, for example?
Exactly. So what the coronavirus has done is exposed tremendous fault lines in our community, huge chasms where people just are not able to follow the Center for Disease Control's recommendation. And this is due to long-standing hatred on some level of the Native American community. So we found the Navajo Nation, 40% of the people are living there without running water, which would make the order to wash your hands as often as possible horrible. Not only did the government not step up, to install plumbing for the nation, the Navajo Nation, we had Doctors Without Borders, which is unheard of in America. Doctors Without Borders was who responded to the Navajo Nation. So I think that is really almost unbelievable, but it happened. It happened. And so that community is being hit particularly hard. What we are also seeing in just here in New York City is that there's this cradle to grave stratification of how the virus is affecting people of color and white people. So not only is it devastating older people in nursing homes, it's evidently twice as many black and brown people are being affected with COVID in nursing homes. So white people are being affected, older white people, but black people are being affected, according to the New York Times, at almost twice the rate of infection. We don't have all the answers to why that is happening. Do African Americans have more comorbidities? But we just know that it is happening. So in my life, I have two friends for the past 40 years who are healthcare workers, who are home attendants, as we call them. But I call them not at home attendants. I call them healthcare workers. They are going in and oftentimes doing things that a nurse would do, changing IV for people, you know, who need it. They are changing diapers. They are doing complex, you know, hard work that other people don't want to do. One of the things that home attendants that I know are telling me, and I just know two, so I don't know a million. How many do you know? You know, are telling me is that there is no way for them to get the protective equipment that they need. That equipment, when there was a shortage, and there evidently is still a shortage, went first to doctors and nurses, and not to people who were working in nursing homes, or who were doing work going into private homes. So there's many disabled people and older people who are saving the government money by living at home and having a healthcare worker come and attend to them, you know, and that's keeping them out of state institutions. But they are not provided with the equipment they need. And now the government has backed away from free testing. And these people who should be tested every time they go into a facility or a home or whatever, or, you know, they are trying to make the women who earn under $22,000 a year many times pay for their own testing. So all of those things make a difference in who will live and who will die.
And that's so stark and clear in the way you've put it. And I don't think people understand these issues, even though we are obviously seeing new things happening around us. For example, I woke up to the news a couple of days ago that NASCAR, of all sports, is banning Confederate flags. The fact that there's any sport in 2020 that needs to ban Confederate flags is another conversation, but that's progress. We're seeing that Gone with the Wind has been pulled by HBO, will be brought back. HBO Max will be brought back in context, they say. We are seeing Confederate statues in some cities being torn down and tossed away. First of all, your reactions to some of these little signs of change in this country.
I think these are big signs of change. You know that you've probably been to Berlin and Germany. You know that in Germany you cannot walk around wearing a swastika. You just cannot. It is against the law. You cannot actively promote the hatred of Jews. You know what I mean? So to have these symbols of in our country of people who tried to overthrow our country. There is no Confederate heroes. The heroes fought against the Union of the United States and wanted to form a separate country. That's no different than, you know, black radicals wanting a state in Texas, or white nationalists wanting a state in Washington, you know, in upstate New York or in, you know, Northwest America. These were people who fought to destroy the Union. Confederates are not heroes. So the just the recognition of that, and we need to stop allowing any segment of our community to publicly and with government sanction idolize Confederates, slaveholders, or anything else. So if that's what you want to do at home, if every, you know, you have that right at home. You have that right to wear blackface at home while you eat dinner. You have that right to, you know, walk around with rifles and have civil rights, civil war reenactments in your backyard. But the state government, you know, national institutions, we should not be idolizing Confederates, racists, any more than we should be idolizing Nazis.
In that comparison, I think you're absolutely right. Nazis and the swastika in that context is the same as a Confederate flag today. And I can tell you, as a young kid, I didn't pay attention to this. I grew up overseas, as I think you know. I was born abroad, but I came here when I was 9 years old. And when I saw Dukes of Hazzard, that TV show, I just, as a 9-year-old boy, I just thought it was cool and didn't even care about the Confederate flag being on the General Lee, as the car is known. And the fact that the car's name is General Lee, like, that should be horrifying, right? But as an immigrant, right, as a 9-year-old, soon to be overeducated, privileged immigrant, I had no idea.
And I think, you know, my generation grew up watching cowboy and Indian movies, you know what I mean? And rooting for the cowboys, you know, to win, you know, the cavalry to participate and win in the genocide of the Native American people. So we all grew up with a mythology, you know, of what America is. And that doesn't mean that America is not a great nation. It means that it was a nation based on the genocide of Native American people, you know, of tricking them, of taking their land, of deliberate infection with diseases like smallpox and syphilis. These are things that we did. We lied. We broke treaties. And the after effect of that is that there was an agreement when Native American people, you know, went to certain places called, that was their land, that was called reservation, that the United States would produce infrastructure into those lands in terms of plumbing, in terms of electricity. That is why there is no plumbing in the Navajo Nation. You know what I mean? The United States never stepped up and you know, provided their part of the bargain to produce it. But the why it is acceptable is because we have spent almost as long as television has been in existence, we have spent time looking at movies and television shows of noble white men like John Wayne kill Indians, you know, kill them and see them as wild savages who scalp and rape white women, of uneducated, evil people, as opposed to people who were deeply affected and responding to the genocide, the violent massacre, the decimation of their numbers, and were fighting back with the weapons they had. Yeah, you know, by the time the war against the Indians was going on, we had revolving weapons, you know, basically machine guns. Yes, they had, you know, a tomahawk, you know what I mean? They fought back with what they had, but somehow that we wiped out huge numbers of them and then classified them as savages because they fought back with a tomahawk or a bow and arrow is ironic in a certain kind of way. But that disdain and hatred for the victim of white genocide, because it's easier to hate the people you victimized than to have compassion for them, because if you hate them, you never have to make up for the wrongs you have done. If you have compassion and understanding, it means that you begin to allocate federal, state, and municipal money to begin to improve the plumbing on Native lands. So as long as you're calling them savages and talking about their alcoholism and their high HIV and their, you know, low literacy or whatever, then you don't have to do anything. And that is what myself as an artist, have to address. Artists acted in those movies of killing. Artists wrote the script. Artists created the music, you know, that epic music that comes down during the Indian battle when the white man rides in all alone by himself and kills 99 Indians. There's music behind that. It's almost orgasmic. A musician wrote that music. So artists, you know, maybe out of hunger, or maybe they had right-wing ideology and hated Indians, but somewhere along the line, art has been used to promote genocide.
Wow. And I want to talk to you about your life as an artist and the things you're working on, but we have a caller that we want to bring on. Please tell us your name. You're on WBAI right now. Tell us where you're calling from, too, please.
Hi. Thank you. It's Joan from Manhattan, and thank you for this program. I just wanted to express my concern that we're reopening everything too soon. The states that have reopened, they're seeing spikes of cases now. And Andrew Cuomo, who I think very well resisted pressure for quite a while, and the numbers of deaths have been going down every day, and I would love to see it go down to zero, really. It's close to zero. That's 36 a day or something, 56, down every day. And I would like to see us not reopen until we're down to zero, and then we've got this virus thing on the run like they have in New Zealand, where they have zero cases. But I think one of the reasons, I understand the pressure to reopen because people don't have enough money. And I just wanted to compare us. It's dangerous to compare us to Canada. We always fail miserably when we compare ourselves to Canada. But if I'm not mistaken, Canada has given every man and woman in the country $2,000 a month payment since March. That's $8,000 each so far. Compared to the $1,200 that we got, if we got it, and there you don't see protests in Canada. You don't see people demanding reopening early because I guess they have a way to eat and pay their rent and some basic expenses. And plus, of course, they have national health insurance, so they don't have to worry about that. They don't lose their insurance when they lose their job, the way 27 million people now have just lost their job to this pandemic, and with it their health insurance at a time when they need it most. So I'm interested in your comments on that. Why do you think we always have the least good, cheapest, worst possible, pathetic little social programs, if we have any at all? That's a big question, I know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joan, for your call. We are grateful for your passion on this topic and your clear-eyed question about this. I'm going to have Sapphire answer that in just a moment. I want to say to everyone, we love your voice. Please dial in. Please call in. Tell your friends, 212-209-2877, and you can be on the air on WBAI with the wonderful Sapphire, the writer, novelist, and poet, who will be sharing with us some of her art, and talk about her creative process as well. So please, Sapphire, your thoughts.
Yeah, one of the things that crossed my mind is that we have this individualistic motto response that to public policy and problems. So this is a global pandemic. It's hitting us on a national and individual level. And instead of doing something like France, what France did was pay employers not to fire their employees. In other words, and keep them on the payroll instead of sending, you know, $1,000 here or something like that. They sent it to the employers. Keep paying your employees. So we didn't have that. So we have this massive layoff. And then we also have some of the population themselves who feel we can make it if we try. No, you can't make it when you have something on a catastrophic global event. We need our government to respond to us. People should be being paid to stay home. People who are essential workers should be receiving free, you know, protective equipment. They shouldn't have to be struggling for masks and stuff. So what is happening is we have a national collective tragedy, and people are being, as our caller said, are being asked to respond on an individual level. But that is part of the mystique of this country, that rugged individualism made it. No, rugged individualism did not build the economy of this country. Slave labor built it. It was built upon slave labor. So, and then you could have one plantation owner riding around his plantation talking about, look what I've done, when the reality is 300 unpaid workers did that. So again, this country was never afraid of slave labor. It was never afraid of, of genocide, but mention socialism, mention Bernie Sanders, and all of a sudden people got terrified. So real solutions to our problems would be beginning to do some of the things that Bernie Sanders was talking about, and that is free Medicare for everyone. You know, how, why should someone be going to work sick? You know what I mean? So why should someone be working in a meat plant where they can't socially distance? You know what I mean? Why were all the meat plants consolidated so that, that four plants were processing most of the pork in the United States? What happened to all the small animal growers, you know, small farms that were independent and trying to grow organic meat? So many, many of the issues that I think our caller is talking about have to do with our inability to come up with a group, a national solution for these problems and keep voicing it over to the individual. What is a family of four going to do with $1,200? That's my question.
Thank you, Sapphire. And the answer to the caller's very thoughtful question about why do we have the worst outcomes in so many things? Canada is one example, but look at South Korea, a country 15 times denser than the United States, a country that got its first case, confirmed case, the same day as the United States. And the number of deaths that they had in the first 2 months were less than what we were having on some days in this country, the number of deaths. And that tells you the source of all of this, as Sapphire knows so well, is hatred of government, the vilification of government, that authority is bad, and all of it. And I, as you were saying about who built this country, you were reminding us that slaves built this country, slave labor made it happen. And of course, you remember when President Obama had the gall to say that you didn't build that, that it takes an entire system, a civic system, a civil society to have success. You remember all the vilification he got?
It
was a huge scandal that he said, you didn't build this. I know as a very small businessman myself, I'm trying to build a business, but it's built on government and other elements of society letting me build my very tiny business because they provide the safety, the security, the other ways that I have the freedom to do what I do. I did not build this. Mine is very small, but you understand what I'm saying. And I don't think enough of those Silicon Valley people who are all libertarians for the most part will admit to that, that they did not build this. We all built it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And at the same time as some of us have been allowed to build, you know, on some level, so many people have not, you know what I mean? So many people are just trapped in this cradle to grave poverty that doesn't allow for anything. And one of the things that concerns me right now in New York City is people seem to, again, have this rugged individualism in terms of the school system. So we have the most segregated school system in the United States. You know what I mean? In other words, we have a small group of elite schools that are basically only white and Asian, these high-performing schools. Then we have these other schools that are disaster areas that are black and Hispanic. And at any time you try to question that, up comes the thing, well, my kids worked hard. We worked hard. No, you had a system that allowed you to work hard, that meant you weren't scrubbing other people's floors 12 hours a day, that meant you could invest in your life and your children in a way that poor people could not. It is not an equal system. And a test that your kid got a higher test score than some black kid who probably has the same IQ and the ability but is working 8 hours a day at McDonald's doesn't mean that you have a right to the best schools. This needs to change, and this is a real sore point, but it comes back to that very same thing of this rugged individualism. We worked hard. You niggers didn't work hard, and therefore you do not get to reap the benefits of the society that you helped build.
And that division between people of color has been coming out in many cases, and that's one of the other problems that we're facing. We have several callers, and we want to remind everyone you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM and available worldwide on WBAI.org. We hope you will support WBAI in any way you can. We would love for you to be a WBAI buddy and support us so that we can continue to bring you programming like this and all your favorite shows on WBAI. Please go to WBAI.org and check out the many ways you can donate and what kind of rewards there might be for you to be a supporter of WBAI radio. Listener-supported radio means the listeners have to support us. You can donate and support in the name of this show or any of your favorite shows on WBAI. And please do follow WBAI on the radio, on Twitter, WBAI, at WBAI. And I'm on Twitter, at Sree, S-R-E-E. We want your feedback. And please follow Ms. Sapphire on Twitter. She is new, and her Twitter handle is Ms. S-A-P-P-H. So Ms. Sapphire, if you search Sapphire, she comes right up top. She is new to Twitter. Let's go to another caller. You're on the air on WBAI. What's your name? And tell us where you're calling from, please.
I'm calling from Brooklyn, and my name is Denise, and I am finding the program very, very interesting. The thing that I want to kind of express, I am a black woman. I understand why it's absolutely necessary for us to express the heartfelt thought of Black Lives Matter. But what concerns me is that I think that the arena needs to be open more so that all segments of the population will understand that the brutality that we're expressing, that we're experiencing, is permeating throughout. This kind of filth permeates throughout through economic bigotry, brutality, the destruction of our air, water, and foods. That will affect everyone, every single person in the United States and throughout the world. And that needs to be, those facts, those realities need to be expressed by everyone. And then it won't be a situation where how unfortunate for these colored people experiencing this, and they'll awaken to the fact that they are also being discriminated against, and they are also experiencing bigotry. It's just that it appears to me that that expression from everyone, which will make people strive more vigorously to get the kind of America that we need, is not manifesting. And I'd like to see that happen. Sister was just speaking about the Palestinian artist. He is being discriminated. He is experiencing bigotry. And he is fighting for his life as we are. And because he understands that, he used his artistry to depict something that's happening around the world that he is also experiencing. And we must pull our country together in that way, that we have to fight for the environment, for our children, all of our kids. And we must fight together as a country, and we must fight together as a world. That's why you see the world demonstrating. They see bigotry in their environment too, and they have their experiences, and they are just banding with us with sympathy. But it is not only black people. It is not only, you know, it is people, it's not only black people who experience COVID-19 aggressively. There are Caucasian people who live in underdeveloped and deprived area as well. I know some personally, and they are obese, and they have hypertension. We have to make it understood that this is a situation that everybody better get busy, otherwise we won't have anything left. It's just that we as people of color kind of know what time it is, and we have a tendency to kind of sound the alarm much faster than everyone else. But the whole society needs to wake up to what's going on here. Thanks so much.
Go ahead, Sapphire, yeah. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things in terms of the environment, under the Trump administration, most of the Obama regulation against large corporations polluting has been rolled back. I mean, he's done that steadily and insistently, you know, without reason almost. It just in terms of anything that Obama did, I'm going to roll back. So in other words, we had some hard-won victories in terms of mercury pollution of the waterways, in terms of what corporations can release into the air. Those have been rolled back, and they affect everyone. So far, we do not have any white air. You know what I mean? So far, most of us have to breathe the same air. That pollution eventually goes everywhere. It does not just stay within the confines of the inner city. So those type of things are basic. They are happening now as COVID provides a smoke screen for some of what is going on. The other thing is, according to Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, a physicist, now a politician, 70 to 80% of humanity in some way will be affected by this virus. So again, this is not a ghetto thing. You know, it hit us hard because that we were the community that were the least prepared in some ways, and we lived in population density. But this is not going to be confined to urban America. This virus, unless we get a vaccine, is not going away, and it will affect everyone. And one of the ways that it is exposing another fault line that is affecting everyone, and this affects white middle class people, is that we have a hospital system that is basically for profit. So we have a system that has prioritized high-paying surgeries, sometimes unnecessary, over basic critical care. So all of those things are not black issues. And, you know, a large portion of the United States deals with obesity, hypertension, and even people who are relatively healthy will have more comorbidities as they age. Very few people 80 or 90 years old don't have hypertension, whether they're vegans or not, you know what I mean, don't have a lowered kidney function. So all of these things are things that are going to affect us en masse. And what we're really dealing here with is a portion of the population looking at another portion of the population and saying they are expendable, not knowing that, as the old adage goes, what goes around comes around. You will not be exempt from this forever. You know what I mean? As people thought with the heroin epidemic in the 1980s in the black inner cities, white people looked at that and turned their nose up and said, that'll never happen to me. Well, who was affected most deeply by the opioid epidemic? White.
Yes.
White. People right. Who thought that heroin would never come for their children had to bury their children just the same way that we had to bury ours. Only when they buried their children, they called them children. When we had to bury ours, they called them black dope fiends. So there is no way that you live in a society and you are not. As the Native American women talked about, the spider women talked about, it's a web. It's a web. And, you know, it's woven together. And when there's a break in that web, everyone is affected. Everyone is affected. So I think that's the message I would like to leave people with. You know what I mean? And there, you know, right now, I'm an older woman, and I'm having to order my groceries. I can afford to do that right now. Eventually, I will be deeply affected and may have to get out and start scrubbing floors or shaking a cup, you know. But so, all you know, we don't know what's happening. We have temporary moments of exemption. You know what I mean? You know, a healthy young person may be at a demonstration and next thing find themselves in a holding cell and infected. You know what I mean? So all of us are vulnerable, which is why we have to demonstrate, which is why we have to donate to bail funds for these young people who are getting arrested. We cannot let this moment pass. and we have to take advantage. You know, for this year, they were unable to do some of the testing. That means that they opened it. That means what we had in the 60s, open admissions, which allowed thousands and thousands of African Americans to go to school. And I was one of them, and I graduated cum laude. But I would not have gone to college if it had not been for open admissions. And I graduated at the top of my class. But left to the old order, someone like me never would have been able to get into college. That, and now we're back at, with the old order. Some people can get in, some people can't. Open it up.
Thank you. We should have told everyone about one of the things that they get when they listen to Sapphire is righteous anger that comes through. And the temporary exemptions that you said, we have a temporary exemption when we are not paying attention. And now this is the world that we live in. Can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned scrubbing floors, that it has been in your past and an incident that sparked some of your anger?
Yes, yes, and it, I'm writing a poem about it now. I actually shared it at a Zoom Bowery poetry club. And when I was a young woman in New York City, going to City University of New York, one of the things I did was I was cleaning houses for on the Upper West Side for these basically wealthy people. And at one point, I was being exploited, and I told the white woman who I was working for, you basically are underpaying me and I need to be paid more money. And the woman told me, I can get a Mexican for less. That was devastating for me, but it was also an eye opener. Here I was at the bottom of the pay scale, you know, a young woman trying to doing this so-called essential work, being exploited. But this woman already had it up her sleeve how to find someone who she could exploit even more, a Mexican. So that was my opening. That was, you know, over 30 years ago. But that was the beginning of me being able to look at what is happening to immigrant women, you know, women who have come into this country, who may be working illegally, who may be, or who may not, you know, but whatever it is, people who don't have access to what I had access to. So I was an American. I had access to legal aid. I had access to many, many of the social services. I was also, you know, had access to the student, you know, student resources. What did it mean that this woman could say, I will get a Mexican? It meant that she would get a woman who had no access, who she could just exploit, who would not get up off her knees scrubbing the floor and ask for more money. And so we always have to be aware of how this country works. And of course, there is no group who African Americans find themselves pitted against more than often Hispanic and Filipino women and this and that. But we have to understand that is exactly part of the strategy. You know what I mean? It works so much easier for the woman whose floor you're cleaning if we're not united, you know, if we are not looking out for each other. So that was a wake-up call for me, that these rights that I had worked so hard for and automatically assumed, even with my lower socioeconomic status at that point, I assumed I had a right to ask for more money. There were people who dared not do what I was able to do. And I think that is a moment of reckoning for everyone. Has that, some people pay attention to it, some people don't, you know.
And thank you for highlighting that and making the point. I just want to read a headline from the newspaper. And the Trump administration finalized a rule to erase Obama era, of course you can fill in the blanks for anything, protections for transgender patients facing discrimination in healthcare. Why in the world would you go out of your way to go out of your way and hurt the weakest, the most traumatized, most, situations of not just this in every case. And as we learned from Adam Serwer in The Atlantic, he wrote this piece that the cruelty is the point. It's not an accident with any of this. I'm so mad. Please help me.
Yes. There is a tremendous, tremendous base on in the right and in the born again, you know, in the evangelical movement that deeply has deeply held ideas about gender. These ideas are so deep that they have been used as an excuse to murder trans people. There have been in the past instances where a man was able to stand before a judge and say, I went to bed with this person and I discovered that they were transgender, that they had a penis and they had pretended that they were a woman, and therefore I became enraged and killed them. And that person was able to walk. Until very recently, that was a viable defense. So the hatred of transgender people is deeply held. And part of the reason it's held so deeply is because we really want to believe in God made man, God made woman, and there is nothing in between. Although we've had scientists, we've had psychiatrists, we've had every aspect of people based in science and philosophy tell us there's a spectrum of humanity. And Trump is upholding the old school. He's upholding the old school. This is a man and this is a woman. And anything else is deeply, deeply threatening. Although he's a filthy liar, because he did tell Caitlyn Jenner, you can use my bathroom anytime. He pretended to be very liberal and, around issues of trans issues. And he sucked in a lot of people. In fact, I'm going to call them out. There were members of the gay and lesbian community and trans community who were fiscally conservative and log cabin Republicans, or whatever they want to call themselves, who supported Trump, not knowing that he was a snake and he would turn on them. So we're really dealing with the heterosexual hatred of people who are different. I can't describe it any other way. And people who are undermining the very fabric of what we've looked at, what we've been brought up to see as normal. And he's doing it. And in doing that, he has satisfied a large segment of his base who depend on him to be as right wing as possible. So he's garnered some votes for that. And the tragic part of that, it's all tragic, but an especially tragic part of that is now people are working so hard to make sure that transgendered people who are, and the group that is most targeted for violence are transgender people of color. There have been murder after murder of transgender women, and most of them are colored. Most of them are colored black. And this has been a travesty. And I want to speak to go in a little bit more deeply into this. Many of the women who are, and it doesn't make any difference, but it's an economic basis. Many of the women who are transgender women who are murdered are also, not all, sex workers. So these are people who are on the lower end of the economic scale, may engage or flirt with someone and end up being murdered. Again, these are the disposable people. So this is all wake-up call. This is not happening. You know, the transgender people are not being murdered in Sweden. This is the result of a state, endorsed hatred of gay, lesbian, and transgender people. And it's incumbent upon all of us, just like, you know, we have the young whites out marching for Black Lives Matter. No, it's incumbent upon all of us to speak out against the abuse of trans people.
Thank you. Let's get a caller in. We're on WBAI with Sapphire, what's your comment? And tell us your name, please.
Hi, my name is Janice. I am so riveted by this whole program. when I walked by my radio and heard that Sapphire was going to be on, I couldn't believe it. And I've been glued to the radio ever since. And I would like to say I really, really, really appreciated the book that I read for the first time, Push, while I was working in the literacy center as an adult tutor. I read it. I couldn't put it down. I cried. I screamed. I threw the book across the room. It was so real because my father was illiterate, and that's what made me to decide to become an adult literacy tutor. And after I read it, I became so emotionally invested in pushing the book that they put the book in the center so we could, you know, go over it with the students. And students had a cathartic experience just reading through some of the stuff they went through because they weren't able to read and they were embarrassed and all the changes that they went through in their life because of it. And I would recommend it to the new tutors. I said, if you're interested in being a tutor, this will be the reason that'll keep you here, you know, because it's a good thing that you do. That was, I mean, just the best book ever. And I really appreciate that book so much.
Well, thank you for that call. What a lovely, lovely you've shared with us. And I know Sapphire is so grateful, too.
I'm just so happy to hear that. I'm so happy to hear whenever my work is put to some type of socially conscious use. That just, baby, that's the Nobel Prize for me. Thank you, Janice.
And we didn't get a chance to talk about your art, so we were going to let you go in just a minute, but I'm hoping you can stay for the transition. We're going to take a break, reset, listen to a piece of music, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk to our guests from Justice Aid as we talk about voter suppression. And Sapphire, if you wouldn't mind staying for just a few minutes at the top, I know they would love to say hello to you. And also, we want to ask you about writing and what you're working on. We didn't get to do that. We talked so much about the other important stuff. I should have booked you for 2 hours. I didn't do that. That's my bad. But thank you so much. And thank you for agreeing to stay. We're going to play a piece of music right now that I know you like, as all of us do. It's to help us think about this moment and where we are. And even as we, in righteous anger, complain about the people who would separate us, we need to stand by each other. So here we go. And please stay tuned. We'll play this music. At the top of the hour, we'll come back with Sapphire, the author of the novel Push that became the movie Precious, and we'll be joined by two board members from JusticeAid.org.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand by.
Hello, hello, everyone. That was Stand By Me, the Ben E. King classic. At a time like this, standing by each other is so important, and we've never would have made it this far if we didn't stand by each other, even though there are so many forces tearing us apart. You're listening to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan. I'm honored to host this conversation 2 hours every Saturday from noon to 2 Eastern, live on 99.5 FM WBAI and worldwide on WBAI.org. And we are continuing our conversation for a few minutes with the author and poet Sapphire, whose novel Push became the Oscar-winning film Precious. And she'll be with us for a few minutes, and then we will have our guest from Justice Aid, an organization that's doing so much to fight voter suppression and other voting rights issues that are so important as we go into November. But I want to first say thank you to Sapphire. I had booked her for an hour, and she's still here.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And we promised our audience that we would talk to you about your craft, because we didn't get a chance to do that because we were talking so much about politics, and politics and craft are so built in together. The creativity matters. Mm-hmm. Please tell us what you're working on. Please tell us what we should be preparing to get from you in the weeks and months ahead.
I think because I write in multiple genres, so I am working on a novel called The Harlem Trilogy, which really traces the family of African Americans from after slavery on up to the present time. And so that is requiring a lot of research and a lot of belief in the future, that I will have a future and that there will be a future to read this book. And I am also working on a collection of poetry, which I had been working on for a while, but which has come to include more and more, I'll call them COVID-19 poems and reflections on the current moment. So I think it's really important as an artist to have the big sculpture that you're working on, but also to have that notebook on the side where you are immediately responding to what's outside your window, to what's happening in your daily life. You know, like I try to keep my feet on the ground as much as possible. And I remember the last time I was in Trader Joe's, just before we had this big shutdown, and I just went up to the young women who were working the aisle and stuff. I said, "How are you?" And I began to get an idea of the seriousness of what was happening with the workers, where one woman said, "I'm scared to death. They won't let us wear a mask because they said it will frighten the customers, but I have a seven-month-old baby at home." So that type of information, I don't take it verbatim, but that's the type of information that starts to filter into my writing. I have a seven-month-old baby. They won't let me wear a mask because it will scare the customers. So here's a person in that type of position. I start to file that away. That becomes maybe a poem, or that maybe goes into, the novel in some kind of way. So for me, that's been very, very important, how to incorporate the moment into what I hope will be documents and literature that will live for a long time. And part of the process of that is, somehow, I know people are doing things differently. Maybe they're recording things on their phone or whatever, but that, I think that's brilliant. But whatever is to be here now, even as you bring your imagination to explore the past, your research skills to talk about the past, and your imagination to do as the great ones like Octavia Butler did to explore a future that we cannot imagine. You are here now, and you as an artist have an ability to record this, the moment that we're going through now, in a way that might be erased if we don't record it. One of the things I'm reading now is a book by Monica Shaw, is how the atomic bomb was suppressed, how they used censorship after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which, as you know, it would be the 70th anniversary this year of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And one of the things they did was to go around to individuals and newspapers and literally tell people, you cannot write that. You cannot show pictures of the burned victims. We want to downplay this. We don't want to show they were being occupied, as you know, Palestine is being occupied now. So the news that gets out is very, very controlled. And who can tell the news but us? Us. So we have that responsibility. Who could tell the news in what was really happening but Anne Frank in her little attic room? You know what I mean? So we are George Jackson in his prison cell. We understood more about what was happening in prison from George Jackson's writing than from the commissioners who went in to discuss and after Attica. They were lying and prevaricating. So we had what we know about prison on some level, we know from prisoners. What we know about the women working on the street, we know from the women who have had the courage to come forward as survivors to tell their story, have had to deal with the shame and the embarrassment, but somehow managed to come forward and say, this is what happened when we interacted with this man. He pulled out a razor and tried to slit our throat. Who would know that? You know, the hunter is talking, not the hunted. So my process, my practice has a lot to do with who I see myself as an artist working for, and that is for people at the bottom on some level.
Thank you, Sapphire. Before we let you go, we are going to talk to you a little bit. We have a couple more questions. And also, if you wouldn't mind sharing that poem you shared at a Zoom call recently, if you can find it, I'll give you a second. I do want to acknowledge our guests from justiceaid.org who are standing by. I want them to come on and just say hello to you, because I know they would enjoy that. Justice Aid promotes justice through the arts and public engagement, a simple and profound idea. So I want to have you meet their two board members who are with us, Brandy Harden and Therese Steiner. Hi, folks.
Hi, Brandy. Hi, Therese.
Hi, Sapphire. Hi, everyone.
And that was Brandy saying hello and Therese saying hello.
Hi, Therese.
Thank you for giving us some of your time. Sorry, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, Sapphire, it's a life highlight, being able to listen to you and see the film based on your work and have you participate in this street call today. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm just happy to be here. Yeah.
Thank you, Therese. And hashtag life highlight has been this entire WBAI experience for me, 3 months that I will never forget, meeting people like Therese and also now meeting Sapphire and other speakers who have joined us for these months of conversation. Brandy, we'll come back to you in a moment, but if you have a comment or question for Sapphire, you can ask it now.
I just want to say thank you for writing such an inspirational book. Obviously, that went on to become a well-known movie. You're an inspiration to all of us young Black women, and I just want to say thank you.
You're very, very welcome. And I want to take this moment to say how much young women have been an inspiration to me. I mean, it's amazing what you're doing. It's amazing the hope and the fortitude of the marchers out there and what you're bringing to this march. People keep saying it's different from anything that has happened before. It's different because of young people. all we wanted as older blacks, you know, when we were out there marching, we wanted to reform. We wanted to reform the police department. Who but you young people could have thought about abolishing the police department? Who ever heard of that? When I heard that, I said, they're on another planet, and you are. Minneapolis is talking about abolishing the police department. That could only happen from young people. I would never have even thought about asking that. So you're amazing. You're amazing.
Well, I think I probably overstated myself because I'm not quite that young, but I will say this. I could not be if you didn't break the barriers to put me in a position to do these things that I'm able to do. So I really, again, say thank you, you know, really to allow us to stand on your shoulders. You paved the way.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm.
All right, Sapphire, thank you for being with us. Let's talk a little bit very quickly about what it was like to see your work in a specific art form in the novel become this gigantic movie that, I mean, it wasn't gigantic when it started, but then it became something that got 6 Oscar nominations and so much attention. Talk about that, please.
It was amazing. It was amazing. One of the things that was amazing, the movie comes almost 15 years after the book. I refused to let people make a movie of it. You know, I had enough to eat, and I just wasn't going to pimp myself out that way. And one of the things the great Lee Daniels told me is he would find a Precious. Other people had come up to me and told me they were interested in hiring someone like Brandy. And I said, no, the girl in the movie is dark-skinned. She's obese. She has short hair. I want someone like that to be the star. I want someone like that to be the star. Women like that in the past have been the maids. They have been the ones who revolved around the beautiful white woman. I wanted the beautiful women to revolve around Precious. I wanted young women to go to the movies and maybe see someone who looked like them or who they knew who was the center of many people's world. And so that was amazing to me to see Gabourey up on screen like that. It was just amazing. It was amazing to me to see issues of young motherhood, of welfare, of HIV, all these things that are you know, stigmatized and associated with marginalized people, they were the focus of the movie. And one of the massive things that happened for me a few years ago was the Center for Disease Control released something, a statistic, and they said for the first time since the AIDS epidemic, the infection rate for African-American women has gone down. And I thought, I'm a part of that. I wrote something that destigmatized HIV and possibly allowed women to begin to seek treatment and come out of shame. And I did that. I did that. And I felt that I contributed to a forward movement. And I was maybe like a drop in the ocean. And then when Lee Daniels comes along, he's like a big ship in the ocean and is able to carry that message further. And I think that I put forth a truth that the filmmaker turned into beauty, humor, and pathos. And I feel very good about that. And nothing will ever take that away from me.
Thank you. And so glad to hear that you are able to appreciate this in your own lifetime, the work that you've done and the impact it has had. Tell us about the 25th anniversary and when that is, and what are you going to, will you be able to do around it? And also that novel that you're writing, the trilogy, Harlem Trilogy, is that a year out or more?
I'm pushing it. You know, I'm trying, and I have a lot of lockdown time, so I'm really trying to rush it. But it can only be rushed so far because I have a lot of research to do. But because I'm going to release it as a trilogy, three different novels, I hope to be able to publish the first part of the trilogy at the same time as the novel Push receives its 25th anniversary outgoing. And I don't know what the exact date is. The publisher contacted me a couple months ago and said, we're going to do this. The time is right. It's time to bring this type of literature back with a bang. So I don't know all of what's going to happen, and I'm going to keep everyone informed. And I am just grateful that, you know, I'm alive to be able to be a part of this. You know, so many of my heroes just left recently. You know, Octavia Butler, Toni Morrison. You know, Wanda Coleman. You know, Lucille Clifton. So we've lost a lot of great Black women. And I'm also doing on a mission to keep the work of Black women poets alive, like Lucille Clifton, like Wanda Coleman, like, you know, the great the Afro-Asian poet. So I really feel very, it's interesting in the midst of all this death and trauma, I also feel very alive and just grateful to be alive, and really feel the fragility of life, and know that I must do, as we all must do, what we can while we can, because tomorrow is not promised.
You're absolutely right that tomorrow is not promised. Before you go, could we get a taste of that poetry you've been writing, your lockdown poetry?
Okay, so this is part of the lockdown poems, and this starts out as any of the first line is what we're hearing all the time. Alone in a house, an apartment, a room, we are together. I feared Ebola, it disgusted me. SARS, MERS, obesity, we are together. High blood pressure, diabetes, underlying conditions, older, 60s, 70s, 80s, we are together. I gather with all those I never wanted to be but have become, old, obese, high blood pressure, COVID-19, once the poor, the working class. I gather together with the bus drivers and food service workers, the subway's iron dust seeding our lungs. I gather with the teachers and the cleaners. We are here in Gotham, the city we watched get clean, the city we got clean in, the city that has perhaps given us the best years of her life. Here we are. It's morning, though we here stay inside. We will listen for the obscene number of those who died, but it's still morning. I gather in the group homes, the cavernous shelters, beds laid out in vast dormitories. I have been there. I am there again. I gather with the homeless headed for Potter's Field. I gather with my brother, his mind wandering, drifting like a cloud. I gather in the green grass of sorrow. Friends, I wish I had known you more. I gather in laughter with my family that I never had, but I gather with my frustrated mother trying to help me. I gather with her loneliness and lack. I gather at the theater waiting for Godot, The Wiz, Precious, Moonlight, The Joker, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Didn't we see Glenda Jackson and King Lear, The Slave Play, Show World, Soul Cycle? I gather with girls in G-strings dancing on pool tables in the Combat Zone. I gather on the Upper West Side, the clean white women's houses. They had two sets of dishes, left money around to see if you'd steal. I gathered with those who snapped at me as I bent to instructions and cleaned litter boxes that they could not. I bow to those years that brought me here. I bow to those white people dependent upon me so they could rise socially. They are not in their prime anymore. 40 years has passed. They are crying faces, laying in their feces, abandoned in nursing homes. They are treated like they treated me, dispensable, replaceable, invisible. I get up off my knees and ask one white woman for more money. She tells me she can get a Mexican for less, and she does. But I am not happy to hear about bodies stacked up and decomposing in the basement of a nursing home. In fact, I gather with them, old and white. I gather with the tired brown women who left them laying in their feces, the brown women who wanted good schools for their kids but got police shootings. And you said we must have done something for the police to shoot us. We said you must have done something for your kids to stick you in a nursing home. I gather with you. Take my gloved hand. I gather the great and savage inequalities. I listen for Gotham's morning body count, and I gather in the light of a new day. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. I've got goosebumps and tears in my eyes at the same time. I didn't know that was possible. Thank you so much, Sapphire, for sharing that with us. We are privileged. We are honored by your presence. I am so grateful to you for sharing that with us and this your poetry and your thoughtfulness and your insights all in one beautiful piece of art that you have made and shared with the world. We hope you have big plans for that piece of art, and we'll get it out there. Folks, our guest has been Sapphire, the author, the poet, the artist filled with righteous anger, who inspires us to look beyond what we know and look beyond this moment and to look outside our circles of comfort. Please follow her on Twitter. She's new on Twitter, Ms. Saff, M-S-S-A-P-P-H on Twitter, and encourage her to continue posting and sharing her thoughts and her insights, even as she's locked down in New York City. Thank you, and we hope you'll come back and talk more with us.
Okay, bye. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you. Wow, folks, that's been some start to our show. I want to bring on now our guests from Justice Aid, an organization that's doing so much that we should all learn about. And they were so patient as they listened, as we all did, enthralled by the magic of Sapphire's words. Justice Aid was formed in 2013 around a simple but profound idea to promote justice through the arts and public engagement. We're joined today by two board members, Therese Steiner. Hi, Therese.
Hey, Sri, how are you doing? What an incredible reading.
It was amazing, and we're so glad you could hear, listen in, as everyone who's listening in now. And we're also joined by Brandy Harden from the board. Hi, Brandy.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me, Sri.
Yes, and we should say that you folks have a big event tomorrow. But before that, Brandy, any thoughts on that poem?
Amazing. Honored to just be able to hear about it, to hear the passion with which she gave it to us. I think we're just lucky to still have artists like this that are able to put out their thoughts in an emotional way and for an impact on all of us.
Thank you. You folks have a big event tomorrow. Let's hear about that. I've been honored to help out in a minor way, but this is a big, big event to help people understand what's happening with our society and voting.
Brandy, do you want to start off with a few comments and then I'll jump in?
Oh, you can take it on.
Well, thank you so much, Sri, and we're so honored to have you as one of our honorary hosts. Justice Aid, as you said, we promote justice through the arts. And every year we pick a theme that we think will be very relevant in the coming year. And little did we know when we picked voting and voting suppression how incredibly topical it would be. Every year we pick a beneficiary who's works on the cutting edge of that particular issue. And our beneficiary this year is election protection of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. It was started at the recommendation of JFK in 1963 in the heart of the civil rights era and right before the Voting Act right was enacted by Congress. So they do incredible work. They do incredible work every day on the ground in their field offices. If you have an issue relating to the election, you call 866-OUR-VOTE. They will help you. They will help you register. And we're very proud to be honoring them as a beneficiary. We raise money in a concert, and we also raise awareness for them and the issues at hand in a public forum. So our public forum this year, which is tomorrow at 3 o'clock or 8 o'clock on the Riverside Church YouTube channel, is called Lift Every Voice and Vote. And it's a public forum on voting and voter suppression. And we have an incredible, incredible group of panelists and speakers who will be participating, including Stacey Abrams, Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Maria Teresa Kumar of Voto Latino, Kristen Clark, who is the President and Executive Director of Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, in a panel moderated by award-winning journalist Ray Suarez. And we also have musical contributions from Abina Kumsum Davis and the Resistance Revival Chorus, and the incredible Matthew Whitaker, who's a 20-year-old blind jazz pianist, incredible, who's already performed several times at Carnegie Hall. So we hope everyone can join us. Tell all your friends, 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock tomorrow. Sri, you're very good at recommending that we repeat things. They talk about voter suppression. They give incredibly inspiring. Stacey Abrams and Representative Jeffries are incredibly inspiring about the history of voter suppression in our country and how important it is to get out and vote. And I just want to say that I myself have been very moved by the events of the past few weeks. I'm very moved by the fact that Terrence Floyd, George Floyd's brother, in the midst of everything that he and his family and the community is going through, he said, let's stop thinking that our voice doesn't matter and vote.
And everybody needs to vote, and everyone needs to tune in tomorrow at 3 p.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Riverside Church YouTube channel for this great conversation. Brandy, let me bring you in. You're also a board member. Tell us how you've been thinking about the issues of our time, everything that's happened in the last few weeks, and how that bumps up against the issue of voter rights in our country.
So I feel like obviously the events that have taken place the last couple of weeks are just overwhelming. We've been able to see just how easy it is to suppress minority vote, the black vote, voters altogether. I voted in a local election here in D.C. and stood in line for 2 hours just to cast a vote, notwithstanding the pandemic, notwithstanding how hot it was. And I think that the more difficult that you make it for people to vote, obviously there's going to be more voter suppression. And I just think that that's something that's been unfair in this country, that something that's been going on. And I think that it's really, really important for folks to pay attention because our voices do matter. And I think that over the last week, we've been able to see just how much change not only your voices make, but obviously being heard makes as well.
And let's make it clear to everyone that when we say kind of these voting issues, voting problems, like these are not accidental. These are a planned strategic effort that goes back decades, goes back more than a century to suppress the vote. It is not like, oh, look at the difficulties we're having today. This is all calculated by one political party to keep people from voting. In every other country in the world, it's a good thing when people vote in most democracies. But here we are in a situation where one political party does not want people to vote. How do you explain that to people?
I think it's obvious, right? I mean, I think that one political party thinks that if more minorities, because quite honestly, that's who's being targeted, more minorities go out to vote, it doesn't bode well for them. But like you said, I mean, I do just want to be clear. All of this is systemic oppression. I mean, it's the same things over and over again, even if it comes down to requiring people to have a driver's license or requiring people to have a state-issued ID in order for them to go and vote. You're just creating more hurdles and making it more difficult for folks that are already disenfranchised in the community. And it's unfair. But again, it just goes back to a long-standing practice. And for me, just to be quite clear, it all starts with the 13th Amendment. You cannot have a society talk about how things have changed when we are affirmatively in 2020 saying there are a group of people in our society that remain slaves. I mean, there's nobody who can challenge what the document says. Slavery is abolished in this country except as punishment for crime whereof the person shall have been duly convicted. And so if we're starting from a mindset that there's a certain segment of society that are still, in fact, slaves, I think that just trickles down to our communities.
And so just Sri, to be clear for folks, for folks who are listening, and you know, I want to give credit to the folks who are trying to learn. So explain how we can address this issue and how that fits into the overall policy framework that we need to address, please, Brandy.
Well, I think one of the things that we really do have to do is I think we have to have legal observers, right? We have to have people at the polls that are making sure that the process is fair. And I think if we can do that, we can push the vote, we can get people out, then we're more likely to have a successful election. I think what it really comes down to is what is happening at the local level, what is happening at all of these different poll locations. And if there's not somebody there essentially performing community oversight or ensuring that the process is fair, I think we have more problems. And I think what we are trying to do through our work at Justice Aid and certainly through our voter suppression work is to let everyone know just how important it is to ensure the integrity of our elections and to make sure that people don't get disillusioned and don't feel like my voice doesn't matter and change their minds and don't come out to vote. So getting people out, getting legal observers at these polls are certainly some of the most important things that I think we have to do.
And so what are some of the things that Justice Aid is promoting and asking people to think about in all of this? And I want to remind everyone, we're having a conversation with two experts and two board members from justiceaid.org. They have a big forum tomorrow where you can hear from Stacey Abrams and Representative Hakeem Jeffries, journalist Ray Suarez, and so many other fascinating and influential people. And you're listening to WBAI FM 99.5 right now. Our show is called Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful show. And the connection between voter suppression, voting rights, and the issue of COVID-19 is that we have seen in the last few days elections in Georgia taking place. And before that, elections in the Midwest where there were problems and people were not able to vote. People stood out with issues around masks and everything else. And it's all tied together in these ways. Folks, we'd love for you to call in and talk to our guests, ask them questions. We want to make sure that you have a chance to do so. We want you to call in. Our number is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. You can tweet us at Sree, S-R-E-E, at W-B-A-I, or the hashtag W-B-A-I-S-R-E-E. We want to hear from you, and we want you to talk to our guests. Let's go to Therese Steiner and have her tell us a little bit about what you are all thinking about in terms of where we go from here.
Well, thank you, Sree. And Brandy is so passionate and so right about things that are happening on the local level. And everything we do, we like to have a call to action. And we have a call to action this year, and it'll all be outlined in the forum. And this is our main call to action. Number one, everybody make a plan to vote. It sounds simple, but you got to do it. If you don't know if there's vote by mail in your particular state, if you don't know where your poll is, go to 866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-OUR-VOTE. That's the hotline for election protection that's open 24 hours a day. You can you can go on to the website with the same name and find out the information in your state. So if you call 10 friends and get your 10 friends to do the same thing, make a plan to vote. If people aren't registered, figure out a way to register. Go to 866-OUR-VOTE or voting.org, and you can quickly register in your own state, which is vitally important. The second thing is we recommend that you call Congress. There are a couple of major acts that have been passed by Congress but not passed yet by the Senate. They're the HEROES Act. It's a stimulus package. It's proposed by Senator Harris. And it has a lot of things added to the stimulus, but in that plan is a plan to fund post office. The post office is running out of money. You can't vote by mail if you in many states if you do not have a stamp and whatever, it has to be mailed. And, of course, Klobuchar's Emergency Ballot Act that specifically calls for vote by mail. So that's another act you can do. If you spot voter suppression happening while you're voting or just something that you know is going on right now, you can call 866-OUR-VOTE. They have lawyers who will be answering the hotline phones, and they will respond. They will take action, and they will file a lawsuit. If you're having a problem voting yourself on the day of the election, Election Protection will send a lawyer down to help you. So, and the last call to action, of course, putting in another merciless plug, but please tune in tomorrow for this forum. There are so many striking incidents of voter suppression in action that the panelists talk about. If it's okay, Sri, I'd just like to mention one that happened in Texas. Maria Teresa Kumar talks about this one. It was in a Latino community in Texas. And before the election took place, this was the 2018 election, flyers were distributed saying that if you had not paid your electricity bill, you could not vote, which is a lie. Flyers were distributed that said if you live in a mixed status household, meaning in your household that you have people who are legal American citizens and legally here and people who are not, you cannot vote. That's another lie. On election day in this predominantly Latino district, two blocks down from the polls was an ICE rally all day long. Very, very difficult if you live in that community to feel you're going to walk by an ICE rally and go in and vote. So these are the real things that are happening. I don't know how people think these things up, honestly. But show voter suppression in action is predominantly in communities of color. And we have to do everything to fight it and get out and vote and overcome it this election.
Thank you. We have a couple of callers standing by. Let's go to our first caller. You're on the air on WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, Sri. It's Russell up in White Plains. I agree. Voter suppression is a huge problem, but I don't think voting by mail is the answer. I'd like to refer you to Jerry Nadler himself, who is on the YouTube saying, I know from my experience in New York that mailing in ballots is not good. Mail rooms are not secure, and things get done with ballots. But I'd really like to ask a question of you, Sri, because you're a digital expert, and I'd like to talk to the two lawyers about driving while black. Could we not eliminate driving while black by having all cars connected through GPS and artificial intelligence, so speeding, tailgating, weaving in and out, that can be monitored, people can be fined remotely, and we can stop this driving while black and take away one of the worst tasks that cops have to do. They are most afraid when they're stopping cars. That's when they get injured and killed. They hate giving out tickets. I mean, some probably like it. But we should take this away from the cops, and then they would be appreciative. We should work together. So, Sri, you're a digital expert. You know, I'm a college dropout, man. I talk into the breeze for years about this. Nobody listens to me. The police don't listen to me. You are an elite. Please implement this and save us all. Thank you very much.
Sri, it sounds like the question was for you, but I certainly have some input on that as well.
Please, to you first. Our guests are Brandi Harden and Therese Steiner from justiceaid.org, and Brandi is going to reply to Russell from White Plains.
Yes. So, Russell, thanks for your question. And let me just start with the premise that I absolutely agree. I think that that's what some of the folks that are arguing about defunding the police, I think that's what they mean. I mean, they don't mean take away every dime that the police department has. But, yeah, why do they have to write tickets? Certainly, D.C. has moved to a system of you get caught speeding, you're going to get a ticket by camera. It's going to be $150 to $300. And that issue of speeding is going to be taken care of. And I do think that we should find a way to take the police out of some of the things that just, I mean, we just don't need a police response for. The one thing I really want to address, though, there's no such thing
as driving while black. Let me tell you what it is. Pure racism. If you pull me over just because I'm black, it's not racial profiling. That's now a new, nice, politically correct word. If you pull me over because I'm black, that's the basis for your pulling me over. It's just racism. And so the reality is that that is what we're dealing with. We're going to have to figure out a way to address systemic, open, and notorious racism, because that's what's going on. And unfortunately, right, we have some cases that say the subjective intent of the police officer just doesn't matter. But I agree with you that we've got to find a way to de-escalate the police from interacting with folks, certainly in traffic offenses. I was pulled over once when I was in law school for not having a front tag on my car. Okay, who even really knows that that's required? As long as the tags are registered, as long as they're on the vehicle, who would know that that little obscure law could get you pulled over ultimately and have some kind of negative interaction with the police? So I agree 100%. We need to find a way not to have police involved in such minor things like traffic stuff.
Thanks, Brandy and Russell. Thank you for bringing up the question around this. Are there ways in which connected cars can have an impact? And I'm going to think more about it and talk to friends who work in the air in the space for sure. And by the way, I'll also say, as I am an elite, and that's one of the things that I am now called upon, as all of us who are elite, to understand what other people go through and understand and do something about it. On a previous edition of this show, we had our guest Kimberly Crenshaw, Professor Crenshaw, who coined the term intersectionality. And she said to me, one of the things we must do is say their names of the people who've been killed in police brutality. And that's one of the things we'll do as we end the show. But I want to step back one second and make sure Brandy and Therese heard it. There is a way in which even people who may think they're well-intentioned, like going on a call-in show, as Russell did, and dropping in one sentence and running away onto a different topic, that's how misinformation and disinformation spreads. You all heard what he said. He said that Jerry Nadler was against mail-in ballots, and there is, in fact, a whole thing on the right about how Jerry Nadler in 2004 said something about this. And the Post and the Fox folks and everybody's on it. It's all over the internet. And that's how you sow doubt about our systems. And yes, Jerry Nadler apparently said something in 2004. That was 16 years ago. The world has changed. Technology has changed. People have changed. The systems have changed. It is not perfect. No one's saying that. But to use a comment from 16 years ago and say that's going to, aha, the gotcha moment that they have. And that's what you're seeing. That's the disinformation campaign that we are hearing right now. So I want to hear from Brandy or from Therese. What is the situation with mail-in ballots? And what do you folks say about it? And we should point out Brandy is a lawyer, and she teaches at Harvard Law School, among other places, and is trained as a criminal defense lawyer, so she knows what she's talking about.
I can respond. I just want to start off by saying that we at Justice Aid from the get-go have had a very diverse board, and our board is diverse in terms of race, in terms of obviously male and female, in terms of sexual preference, and especially given what's happened recently, we have had really intense and, for me, meaningful conversations. I have learned so much from my fellow board members as a person who is white, and I just want to thank them, but also recommend that all boards really seek to have diversity on their boards. It's just been incredible for us at Justice Aid, and a very important statement about for who we are, that importance of that. In terms of voting by mail is a very important option this year, especially in the age of COVID. It's dangerous to stand in line. And the vote by mail effort should extend across America to every American. Every American should be able to vote by mail and not have to get a stamp. It should be prepaid, I feel personally strongly. Voting by mail will decrease the amount of people who do go to the polls, because the polls have to be open in many areas, and you cannot go to a poll. It's very hard to go to a poll. It's very hard to do vote-in ballots. For example, Sri, you talked earlier about Native Americans. Native Americans many times don't really have street addresses that correspond on reservations to the post office. So they can't vote, really vote by mail. They can't be found. If you're homeless, if you are disabled, if you need somebody to translate the ballot for you, you have to go to the polls. So vote by mail will allow many people not to get COVID and still be able to vote safely. And therefore, there will be less people at the polls, and the polls will be less dangerous for those who really do need to go into a polling place to vote.
Thank you, Therese. Brandy, your thoughts?
I just think it's important to make your voice heard in whatever way. I mean, obviously, I think mail-in voting has happened in lots of states without problems, and then there are obviously jurisdictions that have had problems. I think tenacity is the key word for this election. You're going to have to be tenacious. You're going to have to make sure that your voice is heard. And I do think with the pandemic, I have a mom who's in her 80s who I do not want to take to a polling location. So I think it's critical in order for everyone's voice to actually be heard, for mail-in voting to work, be accessible, and for it to be an alternate solution for getting our voices out there.
Thank you. We have a caller on standby. You're on WBAI. Thank you for calling. Tell us your name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, this is Hazel from Long Island.
And Hazel.
I love your show. It's so interesting and informative. Thank you to Rez and Brandy. I just want to know, how is this voter suppression allowed to persist? I mean, they're closing voting polling places, they're purging the rolls, they're making these false claims of voter fraud. How are they allowed to get away with this? I just don't understand how it's possible. You know, why aren't people, you know, protesting about this? They seem to get away with it all the time.
So I do think we have a pretty good example of lawyers and legal observers being on the ground and actually, quote, doing something about it in Georgia. You're absolutely right. It's unacceptable and not even believable that polling places could be doing something like closing early or just saying, look, if you're not in line, we're not going to let you vote, those kinds of things. And I think, Therese said it earlier, people have to file lawsuits. And I think we have a good example in Georgia where a lawsuit was filed quickly by the lawyers that were on the ground on the front lines doing this work, and a judge ordered those polling stations to stay open. So I think it goes back to my initial thought, which is we've got to have legal observers, some kind of way, volunteers, people who will ensure that the lawyers who can do something about things that are happening at these polling locations that are illegal can quickly get into making emergency filings or getting before a judge to get themselves heard.
I can add to that in that, as we read in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, there's a big effort by the Republican Party to get a lot of poll monitors. These are people who are outside the polls and who do what Brandy is talking about, monitor. So I would encourage anybody who can to volunteer to be a poll monitor. You can do that through election protection. You can do that through the League of Women Voters. It's a very, very important part of the process. And poll monitors, a lot of them are lawyers, or they have access to lawyers that they can call. The other thing is there is a call for many people who work inside the polls or elderly. They tend to be people who are retired. And for many of them, it's dangerous to show up in the age of COVID, and a lot just don't show up or can't show up. So there is a desire to try to find volunteers to work at the elections who are younger. And it would be wonderful to engage college students and younger people in working on the elections in the elections. So if there's anyone on this call who thinks, you know, what can I do, and you're younger, volunteer to actually work at the polls on election day. That will help, because that will mean more polls can be open.
Thank you. And let's remind everyone about the program that you're hosting at justiceaid.org. The organization's hosting it, but it will be on the YouTube channel of Riverside Church.
I should just say Riverside Church is our partner in this, and we are so we're very honored to be partnering with them on this forum.
And let's remind them of the times and where they can find it.
Absolutely. The times are, it's tomorrow, Sunday, at 3 p.m. and 8 p.m. It'll be on the Riverside Church YouTube channel. And Justice Aid has been posting with links. I know that Riverside Church has been posting with links. So you can find us on Twitter at @JusticeAid_. You can find Riverside Church at @RiversideChurchNY. And at Sri, you're sharing as well, Sri. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we have to say goodbye. Brandy, thank you so much. A final thought from you?
I just want to make sure that everybody understands the importance of this election and that three things happen. Don't let yourselves get intimidated, no matter what's happening at the polls. And when I say that, I mean, even if the lines are really, really long, plan ahead. Don't get out of line no matter what happens. Don't let this election go by without your voice being heard. And make sure you read about the people that you're voting for. Don't just listen to your friends. Don't just listen to the news. Figure out the issues, what people stand for, and make sure that your vote, your voice, is really making an impact.
Thank you very much. Our guests have been Randy Harden and Therese Steiner from justiceaid.org. And with that, we come to another end of another show of Coping with COVID-19, a helpful and hopeful call-in show. One of the things our guest, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, told us to do is say their names. My 17-year-old son, who's our intern on this project for the last 3 months, has compiled a list. It's just a starter list, but I'm going to say their names, and then we're going to say goodbye. Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Calvin Munerlin, Botham John, India Taylor, Natasha McKenna, Alton Sterling, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Philando Castile, Brianna Taylor, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, and so many other names, going back to Emmett Till and everybody in between. We have to say their names. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support. We're here every Saturday, noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Please follow me on Twitter, SREE, and my other shows on Twitter and Facebook. And my YouTube channel is youtube.com/SreeNet, SREENET. We want to hear your feedback, Sree@Sree.net. I'm going to leave you with a song that I love from 1980. It's a hit song by Bob Marley, a ballad to the poor yet welcoming people Bob met in Brazil. The song is Could You Be Loved? Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting WBAI. See you next week, folks. We'll be right back.
Traveling around New York City, one sees many people wearing masks, but others running or on bikes or just walking down the street aren't wearing them. Some not wearing masks try to avoid people. They walk around mask wearers, and still others wearing masks have them down below their noses. And, of course, New York City is nothing like Ocean City, where thousands without masks crowd boardwalks and beaches. But here in New York City, those not wearing masks or wearing masks improperly are worrisome. Can't think they don't care, but cavalier attitudes regarding masks put some of us on edge. Maybe they didn't get the message from New York officials that masks are to protect others. Activist Ajamu Baraka tweets, self-indulgent narcissism equals USA. Governor Andrew Cuomo says there's no legitimate rational explanation.
Well, I don't like the way it looks. You know what? Paint something on the mask, right? Get a new color. You know, you can get a designer mask. It's such a the opposition is so trivial and nonsensical relative to the risk. You could get sick. You could make somebody else sick. Even if you think you're a Superman or Superwoman, you could bring the virus home and get someone sick, and it winds up killing them.
Here at WBAI, you can get one of those interesting face masks. We've created masks which show the value of our radio station, WBAI, and show that we value others. The masks are 100% cotton. They're available in white or black. For a contribution of $35, it gets you a WBAI face mask with our logo and the saying, keep free speech radio alive. Please call 516-620-3602 and ask for a WBAI face mask for a contribution of $35, 516-620-3602, or go to the WBAI donation website, give2wbai.org, and order a WBAI logo face mask. And you'll help us pay for this listener-sponsored free speech radio station, WBAI New York. Thank you for your support.
To you.
Thank you for thinking of me. And I thank you.
I thank you.
Let me say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
This is G-Love on WBAI New York.